Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world's economics and politics. And in about 10 minutes, we'll hear from Emily Gould, who is the author of a new book called And the Heart Says Whatever, and talk to her about being young in New York and in the new media environment and what it's like to be featured in a salacious photo spread in the New York Times Magazine. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Rob Weissman, who is the president now of Public Citizen, about Wall Street lobbying in Congress, why it is that Wall Street leads such a charmed life in Washington, and also maybe about talking about breaking up the big financial sector. So we'll talk to Rob about the economics and politics of big finance. And before all that, some words on this and that. Before commenting on the economic news, a brief follow-up to last week's comments about the 9/11 truthers. It provoked, if not a flood, more than a trickle of emails and bloggy complaints about evenly divided between the patronizing and the hostile. Perhaps my favorite was an email from someone signing him or herself off as a variant on Sky, who counseled me to learn patience and disclosing that 9/11 is a spiritual matter. Nothing makes me want to scream more than being told to be patient. I hate it, for example, when instead of apologizing for the subway delay, the MTA asks us to please be patient. Well, no, I don't feel like it, actually. And as for spiritual, I'm not sure what that really means. I grew up under the influence of the Catholic Church, which has left me with antipathy towards religion of all kinds, and I take spirituality to be some sort of religion light. But I don't get how pointlessly obsessing over something that happened almost a decade ago is spiritual. But I have been impressed over the years by how often spirituality is often a mask for a dissimulated vanity. Its possessors often seem to think themselves more enlightened than the rest of its benighted materialists. Of course, I think I'm more enlightened than most, but I'm out front about that. No false modesty for me. Anyway, I'll drop this topic after this. But aside from the details of the 9/11 obsession, the melting point of steel-type arguments, I really don't get the political point of it. Is American imperial power just a ruse, a trick by a small cabal of plotters? Or is it something that permeates the structures of global politics, economics, and culture, and even the insides of our minds? And doesn't it work with some degree even of our own acquiescence or cooperation? As Michel Foucault famously put it, fascism is in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us. I'm not comfortable with that use of fascism exactly, but certainly the prevailing order derives a lot of its power from the way we've internalized it, something that these sorts of conspiracy stories try to avoid by externalizing everything into neat little plots. Get rid of all the plotters, and presumably everything will sort itself out. Well, Dick Cheney is gone, and things go on pretty much as before, folks. Or do the plotters enjoy some seamless and leakless transmission of power? Okay, on to the mundanities of the dismal science. On Thursday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that productivity rose 3.6% in the first quarter of this year. Productivity is a measure of how much output, measured in the form of inflation-adjusted dollars, workers can create in an hour of labor. Growth in productivity is what makes possible a rising standard of living over time, though it's no guarantee of that. That depends upon how the gains of productivity are distributed. During the troubled years of the 1970s, productivity growth slowed to a crawl in the U.S., which contributed to the stagflation of that time. Then, sometime around 1996, productivity growth accelerated dramatically, and has kept growing at a fairly rapid clip ever since. But aside from a few years in the late 1990s, when there were broadly distributed gains in real wages, most of the gains of that productivity acceleration have gone to the upper orders, to CEOs, stockholders, venture capitalists, and the like, and not to the workers who actually make and do stuff. Moreover, the productivity acceleration of the late 90s was driven by high levels of corporate investment in high-tech capital goods. After the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, however, corporations really cut back on their investment. Since then, productivity gains have mainly come from squeezing the workforce harder while keeping a tight lid on pay. Normally, productivity growth falls in a recession as output falls faster than employment. Not this time. Productivity stayed strong in the recession and initially accelerated with the economy's weak recovery that began in the middle of 2009. In fact, productivity growth in the second half of 2009 was some of the strongest on record, but employment was falling and real wages were stagnant. As a consequence of all this, profits held up remarkably well in the recession and have recovered nicely with only a modest upturn in growth. Can this continue? Corporations remain very tight-fisted about investing in equipment. You can only increase the rate of exploitation so much before you run out of things to squeeze. The whole profit-maximizing strategy of U.S. capital, of starving the public sector, underspending in education, letting the infrastructure rot, doesn't have the look of long-term sustainability about it. But it must be conceded that this approach has worked pretty well for the U.S. ruling class over the decades. As long as things don't start flying apart, and as long as the population continues to play along with the game instead of breaking into open rebellion, they have no incentive to change their approach. Maybe the sense that the approach will turn and bite them in the butt someday is just a form of wish fulfillment. But it does seem like it's going to bite them in the butt someday. Too bad it will probably take more than a few pounds of non-elite flesh along with it, too. But the big crisis on the world scene these days isn't in the U.S., it's in Europe. The EU and IMF announced a large joint rescue package for Greece, 110 billion euros, or almost $150 billion. All that exchange rate has been declining in recent days as Europe descends deeper into the morass. Calling this a rescue package is more than a little misleading. It's designed to rescue Greece's creditors from default and allow the country to keep borrowing in the coming months while it slashes its budget and drives Greece deep into recession. This is the standard IMF medicine. Squeeze everyone so that the financial markets can emerge more or less whole. But despite that pricey rescue package, the markets have been panicking in recent days on fears that it just won't do the trick. Many participants are rightly asking how Greece can service its debts if its economy is collapsing. Many are also wondering how the crisis can be kept from spreading to other countries in the periphery of Europe, countries like Portugal and Spain. If a small country like Greece can cause this much trouble for global finance, what would a much bigger one like Spain do if it hit a wall? One doesn't want to think about that. At one point on Thursday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 1,000 points, or 10%, an enormous hit, before recovering to a loss of only about 3%, which is still a pretty big hit. Some of that decline may have been the result of hedge funds selling assets to cover sour bets on Europe, meaning that several hundred points of that 1,000-point decline could have been market technicals and not true economic panic. But there's plenty of reason for economic panic as well. While I think the U.S. economy is gradually recovering from its 2 years of crisis, we're hardly off to the races. There are some serious structural problems that really haven't been addressed. And while many market moralists are presenting the European problem as one of Mediterranean profligacy, there's a much more fundamental problem with the whole project of European economic unification. As I've said here before, putting poorer countries like Greece and even Spain into the same economic zone as Germany is a recipe for disaster. Germany is far more productive than just about any other country in the world, and few can prosper in direct competition with it. Aside from their tremendous productivity advantage, German industry has also kept the lid on German wages, making it an even more formidable competitor for countries on the periphery of Europe. It's hard to see how the Eurozone can stay intact, really. But who would buy Spanish or Italian bonds if you thought the whole thing was about to fly apart? Our own economic and financial crisis was in large part a crisis of the whole neoliberal hyper-capitalist model, which has squeezing the working class at the core of it. But so, too, is the European crisis. The creation of the euro was a very deliberate neoliberalizing strategy for the European elite, saw as a creaky old system that coddled the workers and needed a series of hard kicks to wake up to American and Asian competition. They've gotten the kicks, but now the recipients are kicking back, not so much in a conscious political way, though there's some of that coming out of Greece, but mostly in a financial crisis sort of way. This should be the terminal crisis of neoliberalism, but neoliberalism doesn't seem to have gotten the message yet. And now a special update prepared for the KPFA and podcast audiences. On Friday morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the employment report for April. It was surprisingly strong, with hardly a blemish hidden under the surface. A reminder, the monthly employment report is based on two very large surveys, one of about 300,000 employers called the Establishment or Payroll Survey, and another of 60,000 households called, unsurprisingly, the Household Survey. The payroll survey showed an increase of 290,000 jobs in April, the best in 4 years. About a quarter of that gain came from temporary census jobs, but even allowing for that, there were healthy gains throughout the economy. Most encouraging, perhaps, was the strong gain in manufacturing. That sector's best showing since 1998, and its third best showing since the factory sector's strong recovery in 1984. The breadth of gains by industrial sector over the last few months is far more impressive than what we saw in the jobless recoveries of the early 90s and early 2000s. We've now added well over 500,000 jobs since the December low. Over the previous 4 months, we'd lost almost that many. The unemployment rate increased from 9.7% to 9.9%, but even that cloud has a silver lining. Remember, to be counted as unemployed, you have to be actively looking for work. If you're not, you're not counted as unemployed. The breakdown of the reasons for unemployment last month were interesting. The number of people losing their jobs fell, but apparently enough people were encouraged by the recent improvement in the job market to enter or re-enter the labor force and start searching for work. And workers are even quitting voluntarily when they don't yet have another job, another sign of growing confidence. I'm not about to strike up happy days or here again, though. There was no wage growth during the month, which is pretty unusual. And not only is the unemployment rate close to 10%, but long-term unemployment, people who are without work for 27 weeks or more, scored another all-time high in April. The economy is still in a very deep hole, and it's going to take a long time before we make a dent in those long-term numbers. The improving tone of the job market will reduce what little pressure there is politically for a public jobs program, but this is exactly wrong because the chronically jobless need help badly. Of course, the U.S. economy still suffers some serious structural problems, and there's a lot of damage still to be repaired. We'll see in the coming months how well this still fragile economy reacts to the withdrawal of all the fiscal and monetary stimulus that's been applied to it over the last couple of years. But longer-term worries aside, it's good to get some good news out of the monthly employment report for a change. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about kids today. That's some of Liz Phair's song. I can't say the word on the radio, but it involves money. That is a setup for this interview with Emily Gould, who was a blogger at Gawker, was the subject of, or wrote rather, a rather notorious article in the New York Times Magazine that prompted an intense amount of hostile reaction about a year or so ago. And now she's out with a collection of little memoirs called And the Heart Says Whatever, just published by the Free Press. And this is a bit off the beaten track for this, this show, but I do try to get out and consort with matters cultural every now and then. So here, interview recorded earlier in the week with Emily Gould. Hi, welcome, Emily. The Heart Says Whatever. I understand that's a Fleetwood Mac lyric, huh?
To be precise, it's a lyric from a Stevie Nicks song from her first solo album, Belladonna. Yeah, the full line is, and the heart says danger, so we're quoting the heart here, and the heart says whatever.
And how did they, as someone who has dubbed the spokesperson for your generation, end up quoting someone from mine?
I think it has to do with the Fleetwood Mac having their reunion tour, their big Rumors lineup reunion when I was 16 years old. So I sort of imprinted on it. I watched that VH1 Behind the Music probably every time that it aired on VH1, which was, you know, every day for a few weeks, I think. Maybe it was around the time that I was having my wisdom teeth out or something. Hopped up on painkillers, watching VH1 Behind the Music. Yeah, it sort of got into my brain and stayed there. I don't really have any.
All right, I will press you on that. The press material for your book says that you are a spokesperson for your generation. How does it feel to be nominated at that title? Do you accept or reject?
It's it's a lot of pressure, and I think it's very upsetting to people because they're like, no, she doesn't have the right to speak for me, and I don't at all want to speak for anyone else. I have no trouble just speaking for myself, but I do think that my generation is uniquely qualified to speak for themselves. Certainly, they have more media and ways in which to broadcast their opinions than any generation ever has before. So, yeah, my generation doesn't need a spokesperson. They are so capable and so qualified to speak for themselves. I put myself out of a job just then, but, yeah, I really believe that.
But it seems like you came to New York sort of pursuing something that previous generations did. You ended up with a job in book publishing, right, which was certainly a very traditional route. Did you feel that was somehow you're getting in touch with the older way of doing things, or is this something you landed in? How'd you ended up starting that way?
I had a lot of internships because I went to school here for a couple of years. I went to the New School, and I was sort of crossing things off the list. I tried working in a small literary magazine, working at a feminist magazine, working at Marvel Comics. I was an intern at Marvel Comics. And my publishing internship was the one that happened to pan out. I mean, it was not a particularly easy time to get a job right when I graduated, much harder now, I think. But at that time, I was going to take a job wherever there was a job for me. And working publishing seemed good because it would allow me to at least be sort of close to something that I wasn't yet ready to admit that I, wanted to do. I was sort of like, well, I want to be a writer, but I know that's impossible, so I'll just hedge my bets and work in publishing, which I think is a compromise that a lot of people still make, and it's not the smartest thing in the world. It's like saying, well, I know I want to be a restaurant reviewer, so I think I will work as a waiter.
The publishing world, though, certainly not collapsing like a newspaper business, but it is on hard times.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, they're in trouble.
But you ended up at Gawker, which, of course, is what made you a celebrity. how long were you there? Like a couple of years?
No, I was there for a year. I quit exactly after being there for a year.
And in the book, and certainly your other writing, you described this sort of increasing feeling of anxiety and loathing about the experience. what was the course and why?
I don't know. Lots of different. I'm not going to be able to be super articulate about this. And this isn't really stuff that I just feel obligated to say, that this is not stuff that the book directly treats at all. The Gawker experience, it really changed my life, and I'm hugely grateful for it. But at the same time, it's something that has the negative consequences of having worked there haunt me every day, and will continue to do so indefinitely, I think. I mean, I can't imagine ever living down. I hope that I will. Just have to, continue to ramp up the ways in which I publicly humiliate myself in scales of magnitude. And then finally the Jimmy Kimmel video will just sort of get squashed to the bottom of that pile. But, I guess it's wearying not just to be perpetually aware of everything or feel that you have to be, and also to constantly be regurgitating it and having opinions about it, but it's also, it's just hard because when you're trying to do that, when you're trying to work that quickly, the opinion that you end up having, because it's the easiest opinion to have about anything, is negative, and being so relentlessly negative is, my soul was tired after a year at Gawker.
Yeah, you described going to a party after leaving work, you had gone to a work party and then went to a performance by your boyfriend's band, and you said it was hard to get out of the habit of scanning the room for people to hate. I mean, is that the reflex that the Gawker experience inculcates?
It was something that was so present in me from, you know, the get-go anyway. I think because of something else that I talk about in the book, it's just this sense of a free-floating ambition that doesn't really have anything to attach itself to. You know you're good at something. If you could just figure out what it is, you'd be a big star. And this is what so many young people who I've talked to feel. And it just makes you hate everyone because they might be your competition, but the reality is that you're doing it to yourself. You know, you've made this little hell for yourself where everyone is somehow the enemy. I think I was really lucky that someone finally sort of gave me permission to, you know, I was sort of waiting for permission to, you know, I was waiting for someone to say, okay, you're a writer, you can go be a writer now. And that moment never comes for the vast majority of people, I think, and so there's this, like, resentment that's very, it really breeds a lot of the sort of, like, random, super hateful things that you just see people saying with no, you know, responsibility on the internet. Sorry, I know I'm kind of babbling.
Yeah, you wrote a book which is somewhat traditional in its form. It's a memoir. I mean, it's almost in some ways the opposite of the gawker kind of writing, which is always in the moment and people constantly hitting refresh, and what happened 15 minutes ago is yesterday's news. So how did it feel to, you know, spend so much time now looking backwards and in contrast to that always new environment?
I wanted to write about things that I hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about before, just to keep it interesting for myself, because I have such a short vlogging attention span and I do get bored so easily. And you know when you're telling an anecdote and it's kind of one that you've told before and you sort of know all the beats and you know when to pause for someone to laugh and you're kind of boring yourself almost? I knew that if I tried to write a book that was like that, my sort of my best, my funniest stories, I just would not, you know, I'd get distracted and start, you know, looking at Twitter, Tumblr, or Jezebel. So instead I tried to challenge myself to remember things that that I'd maybe purposely tried to kind of forget about and to pull those moments out. So it was hard to write about that stuff. And I think I had to take a lot of the energy that I disperse on an average day, you know, in many different little, I liked this photo of a cat ways, and take that energy and really not use it to blog, but instead sort of mush it all together in a ball and use it to make these stories.
Yeah, I sometimes feel like a relic would be too strong a word, but you know, seeing this current media environment causes me some distress. That it makes thinking very difficult and putting things into perspective very difficult. So, do you feel any? I mean, how do you feel about these different forms? I mean, are you trying to live in all these different worlds at once, or do you prefer to write in this book form?
Well, just speaking as a the appointed representative of my generation.
That's how I had.
I do, like a lot of people my age, have one foot in the print past and another foot in the reading everything on a screen future. And I'm able to think in both ways. It's sort of like being bilingual. And I don't know whether the first way is actually moribund. It's scary to think of it as being something that's not going to exist in the future. But, you know, that's what Steve Jobs says. I like to write books, so I hope that books continue to exist.
What do you like about writing books?
There's something nice about pausing and reflecting and saving up some experience, rather than dispersing every thought the moment that it comes to you via twittering about it. And I think possibly, this is more of a hope. I hope that people sort of internally come to that conclusion on their own and stop maybe working and thinking and concluding so quickly, because it's not in the aggregate really good for, I mean, it's, you know, it's not good for your nervous system and it's probably not good for the nervous system of the culture.
Yeah, well, and the reward schedule and the whole, you know, structure of attention is so different. You know, when you blog or your Twitter, if nobody picks it up in 5 minutes, you feel like you've blown it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, the book, it can take weeks, months, even years for people to react to it.
I'd be dead, yeah. I probably will be dead before people write anything positive about this book. That's cool. I mean...
do you find yourself now waiting for the immediate reaction, or are you willing to be a little more patient?
It depends if by waiting for the immediate reaction you mean Twitter searching myself every 15 minutes. I mean, it's nice to be away from my computer right now as we're doing this interview. That's a big relief. Yeah, no, but I think even as you're doing all of that stuff, it's important to keep in perspective that, you know, time has been kind to things that I did in the past that right after I did them seemed like monumental failures, like the New York Times Magazine article.
Why does that seem like a failure?
Oh, just in the moment that it was published and getting thousands of negative comments. To the extent that the Times had to close the comments section, really negative, you know, die, you horrible, horrible person, negative. So that didn't seem positive. But then, you know, in retrospect, I think...
Did the way they edited or packaged it have anything to do with that reaction?
I think whenever you have a photo of a pretty girl lying in bed, people are going to get pretty upset.
Seems like a wonderful subject for a photo to me, but you know, I understand why people would get upset by that. Let's talk a bit about, you know, much of your book is about the process of coming to New York out of college, out of Ohio, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
You arrived here, what, in the early 2000s?
In May of 2001. May of 2001, so, yeah, that fall was...
So the dot-coms had just busted.
Right.
And the New York economy had not yet hit that really crazy boom phase it did in the middle of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what was it? You know, me, I arrived here in various stages many decades ago. But you know, for a young person who wants to come to New York, you know, to make fame and fortune, I mean, is it still possible, do you think?
Well, Patti Smith recently said that New York is done, and that we should try to find a new city if we want to be artists. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that if everyone my age feels like there's an expiration date on our ability to live here, that's sort of built in. I mean, it's not a particularly fun place to be poor, and it's especially not a fun place to be poor, you know, when you're past 30 and maybe have obligations like, you know, a child or a mortgage or something. And also by poor, I mean middle class, because that's what it means in New York.
Yeah, if you're not a hedge fund guy, you can't afford it.
Well, even they're pretty poor now.
Well, they're coming back, it seems.
Good for them.
So you've also entered the video medium, giving cooking shows. Is this just something you want to do on the side, or you really like the idea of cooking before a camera?
Oh, it was actually my friend Valerie Temple's idea. We went to college together at Kenyon, actually. I had... random. This is just an example of how you can have sort of your random ephemeral thought become something real, because I think I had tweeted, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there were a show like Reading Rainbow? This is not a show that your generation is familiar with, I don't think, but it's like an 80s kids public TV show. Reading Rainbow, but for adults. Some actually fun book chat show. Some way to get authors to talk about books they've just written that's sort of more entertaining than, you know, book TV on C-SPAN. And so we had the idea of getting them to cook just because it distracts them from what they're talking about. You're like, chop this cucumber, and then people start talking about all kinds of crazy things. So we've had amazing people on the show. I mean, Sam Lipsight was like a dream come true for me. Upcoming, we have Joanna Smith-Rakoff, Julie Klausner, Mike Albo, Will Leach, whose book also comes out this week. Yeah, a lot of amazing people who have agreed to come to my kitchen and join me in humiliating themselves. So that's really cool, I think.
Do you choose the menu, or do they?
We collaborate, usually. It's gone badly in the past when I've let the guests have too much carte blanche. Recently, with Will Leach's book, which is about baseball, I was forced to eat a vegan hot dog. Oh, my God. Also, he tricked me into eating it because...
I think those things are appalling.
He was like, 1, 2, 3, let's take a bite, and then he didn't. I still took a bite. Yeah, that was a bad scene. But in general, the food that we've made has come out pretty decently well. We haven't ever been being like cut and then spitting it out, so we're not maybe that advanced in terms of our production values. I'm sure that's what they do on the Food Network all the time.
But even so, you haven't given up on the book and doing this show.
No.
The book is a form.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think that in the future we'll all just be watching Vimeo videos instead of reading. I hope not. I don't think that my on-camera presence is really like my strongest suit.
But
we're better on the page.
This does inspire confidence that Twitter isn't necessarily the death of civilization.
You know, in yoga, we learn that everything has within it its negative side and its positive side, and they're inextricable. You can't have one without the other. So yeah, there's Twitter's very dark side, and then there's the positive side of Twitter, the yin and the yang of Twitter.
The yin and the yang of Twitter. That was Emily Gould, who is the author of And the Heart Says Whatever, just out from the Free Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Was some of the third movement of Béla Bartók's Piano Sonata, performed by Martha Argerich. And we're now joined by Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Behind the News, Rob.
Good to be with you.
I do have your title right. You're president?
I am.
Well, it's always good to have executive power here on the other end of the microphone.
I'm sure it's a regular occurrence.
Yes. So let's start by talking about some very serious forms of power. It's just been remarkable that through 2 years of financial crisis now, how little has been done in Washington to reform the financial sector. What is the reason for the charmed life that Wall Street leads in Washington? Is it their personal charm? What is their secret of their success?
Well, I'm sure that many of these guys are charming, but more likely rationale for the failure to have any regulations now a year and a half after the onset of the financial crisis is their political power. That's evidenced most obviously in their expenditures on lobbying and campaign finance contributions. But it really goes much beyond that. It's their influence over the world of ideas, investments in think tanks and academic centers and friendly nonprofit organizations, and the ability to really sort of shape the culture and the thinking about regulation in general, financial regulation in particular, and of course this power extends into areas beyond those of the most narrow and direct concern to the financial industry. So we have an unbelievably silly conversation going on in Washington about reducing the deficit right now. That's very considerably being driven by Wall Street interests.
What do you mean by a silly conversation? What's silly about it?
Well, what's silly is at a time when we ought to be having much more stimulus spending and more deficit spending to overcome the problem that we've got 1 in 6 people out of work or not able to get a full-time job, we're instead spending huge amounts of time here in Washington, by we I really mean in Congress and also from the White House, talking about how to reduce the deficit, which is exactly the wrong thing for us to be doing right now.
But some of the loudest voices on reducing the deficit are heartland Republicans who are far from Wall Street and who at least come out of a political tradition that has historically been not terribly friendly to Wall Street. So how do the folks outside this studio work such magic on the folks of the heartland?
Well, there are different strands of interests that are concerned about the deficit. So there's pretty broad concern among Republicans right now about the deficit because the Democrats are in power. They have no comparable interest in deficit reduction except for a few real hardliners when there's a Republican in the administration. So there's reason to question the sincerity. There's actually a little bit more sincerity and sort of deep belief in this among a lot of Democrats. They care whether it's a Republican in office or a Democrat in the White House. And a lot of them are, some of them are, come from all over the country. Some of them draw on different political traditions, as you say, but a lot of them are under the Wall Street influence, the big dominant influence on the discussion in Washington and really in the country right now is, Pete Peterson and his foundation, which is spending, Peterson, who's made his money from Wall Street and the Blackstone Group, has thrown about $1 billion into the effort to focus attention on the deficit. He's particularly interested in trying to cut back on Social Security benefits, but more broadly is driving discussion about the deficit.
How does that worry? I mean, what does Peterson get for his $1 billion?
Well, for him personally now, I mean, I'm sure there's some monetary self-interest, but by now he's made, he made like maybe not quite seven billion, he made many billions of dollars when Blackstone had its IPO. So he's pretty well set. He's actually now committed on sort of driving this through for his own personal ideological reasons, which I think do flow originally from, more crass monetary interests. He's also personally interested in elevating his own profile and being considered an enlightened philanthropist and an enlightened thinker on the topic. So there's a considerable amount of self-aggrandizement in it for him. And, if you have $1 billion to throw around, you can buy a lot of space in political debates in Washington and around the country.
Yeah, I occasionally go to meetings of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and you can see Pete Peterson in the Pete Peterson room where they hold many of their events. So his influence extends far and wide. But what I meant was, how does he exercise this influence? What is that $1 billion? What does he buy with that $1 billion? What is he? Campaign contributions, conferences, reports?
Well, he's a particular case. For him, it really is really in the realm of ideas. So he's funding organizations. He's got his own foundation, which is kind of an operating foundation that's doing work but also making grants. They're spending a lot of money working with the media. I'm sure there's all kinds of wining and dining of reporters and editorial writers, and we're seeing the ideas from the Peterson Institute or Peterson Foundation reflected in poorly sourced reporting or poorly argued reporting and confused editorials around the country. They've got a movie that they've sponsored and have taken all across the country or continually hyping. They've got relatively high profile people formerly from government now working for the foundation, trolling around and repeating the mantra about cutting the deficit. They have created their own high profile deficit commission to parallel the effort launched by the White House to undertake one of these blue ribbon efforts to attack the deficit and try to get past the, as they say, the tired arguments to the right and left and blah, blah, blah. So that's the range of engagement. That's the kind of thing he's doing to engage in the world of ideas.
Getting past the tired arguments of right and left means embracing the Wall Street agenda, as seen by Pete Peterson. Isn't that
that's right.
Pretty much what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's right. We should be aware, anytime we're being warned about the tired ideas, we should be very wary of what it is that's being offered as a replacement.
Yeah, it's one of those buzzwords like flexible or flexibility and bipartisan that makes you think that your pocket's about to be picked. I'm speaking with Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen based in Washington, D.C. Of course, Peterson's has a longstanding obsession with Social Security and cutting that. And, of course, Wall Street has a great interest in getting its hands on more retirement funds. So is that one of the major fronts that Peterson is working on now, or has he pulled back on that?
That's, I think, a long-term project for Wall Street and probably for him. He and his and his organizations are more focused on just reducing the payouts, the benefits to people if they are right now, than they are on driving the privatization agenda. I think, you know, this is obviously not a reasonable time to be pushing forward privatization on the theory that you're going to get better returns for people when so many millions of people across the country are quite acutely aware that their reliance on the markets for retirement savings has not served them well.
And I want to get to back to the Wall Street thing in a moment, but what about that deficit commission that Obama appointed? You just mentioned that it's Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson co-chairs. Alan Simpson is a frightening fellow who just can't wait to cut Social Security. What do you make of what this is all about and where it's going to go?
Well, what we have to hope for is it's going to go nowhere. But it's sort of a compromise position that came out of the White House. It's hard to know how much it's political theater from the White House to show that they care, in quotes, about the deficit, or how much it's sort of it's genuine. They had pushed the idea of a congressionally authorized commission that would have much more power than this one does, and that idea failed in the Senate, so they've taken it forward. There are at least, I think, 14 out of the 18 who are genuine deficit hawks and really worried about the deficit, really do have Social Security in their sights. So it's very hard to see any positive outcome from this commission. And I think the best thing will be if it just fades away, as most blue ribbon commissions do. But no guarantee that's going to happen this time at all.
And, of course, one of the supposedly more liberal members of the commission is Andy Stern, the departing president of the Service Employees International Union, who said the other day that he thinks we should get past those tired ideas of right and left and talk about adding private accounts onto Social Security and getting that deficit down and just stop fighting yesterday's battles. That's kind of frightening if he's supposed to be one of the more public-spirited members of that board.
Yeah, I think he's one of the four ones who are viewed as sane.
Well, I'm not sure which camp to categorize him in. But let's getting back to Wall Street. You did a report. I had you on here, I don't know, a year or two ago to talk about a report you did about how much money Wall Street had spent in the previous decade lobbying to get everything deregulated. Could you just review some of that before we talk about what they're up to right now?
Yeah, I mean, what we put out was sort of shortly after the onset of the financial crisis. We looked back over that previous decade from 98 to 2008 and found that they'd spent over $5 billion on lobbying and political contributions, about two-thirds of it on lobbying. And then we focused as well on the revolving door, the number of former government employees or members of Congress or members of congressional staff who were working as lobbyists for the industry. And then we connected that political influence to an identifiable set of deregulatory moves that helped precipitate the financial crisis.
And $5 billion over 10 years, and that's what a third of what Goldman's bonus pool was. So, this is a lot of money by the standards of Washington, but pocket change for Wall Street, basically.
That's right. I mean, and this is sort of going forward, especially after this recent very bad decision from the Supreme Court in the case of the Citizens United, the corporations can spend directly whatever they want out of their treasuries to influence the outcome of elections, really highlights the disparity between the resources that are available to corporations and the amount that is spent or needs to be spent to influence election outcomes. So if they choose to escalate by an order of magnitude the amount that they spend in Washington, this is true for Wall Street or really most other large industries, it's completely available to them to do it.
How does Wall Street stack up against those other industries? You know, the pharmaceutical industry is a notorious spender, oil and gas industry as well. But how does Wall Street stack up?
Well, the broad financial sector is probably the biggest spender in Washington. Wall Street as a subcategory, so excluding insurance, excluding the real estate interest and so on, that as a narrower category is a very major funder, but not nearly as big as the broader financial sector. If you go to these narrower groupings, the pharmaceutical sector is probably the biggest and most aggressive and strategic spender, and Wall Street's probably right behind them.
Wall Street right now is certainly not popular with the American public, and you would think this would be a prime time to see some serious financial reforms, a serious financial regulation adopted. That's certainly what we've seen, you know, after past financial crises, but we're not seeing it after this one. How have they been successful at fending off popular outrage?
Well, I should say before I answer, I think this thing, it's a little bit in play right now, and there's some openings that didn't necessarily seem like they were going to be here 2 weeks ago. So a little bit, this is kind of an inside Washington view. It's not necessarily the view from outside, but I think it is accurate.
Yeah. How much does the Goldman stuff have to do with that?
Goldman's been helping. But to go back to the premise of the question, which is right, I mean, both have, you know, it's been an incredible delay, a year and a half, more now since September 2008 and the onset of the financial crisis. Nothing passed through Congress to respond in any meaningful way in that time. So the delay has been a tribute to Wall Street power. And then the package that has passed through the House of Representatives and that had passed through the Senate Banking Committee, it contained a number of quite useful measures, one important one being a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, in the case of the House, or less satisfactory but still important bureau, sub-agency in the case of the Senate bill, and some other useful things. So that's what we had out of the House and going forward from the Senate Banking Committee. And, you know, kind of a bunch of things that are pretty good that you would have felt not so bad about if they had been adopted in 2006 or 2007, but are just wildly incommensurate with the scale of the financial crisis and the harm perpetrated by Wall Street on the national and global economies. What's been missing, and I think now is sort of entering the debate surprisingly at the last minute, but what's been missing are much more structural features and things that actually would be harder for Wall Street to game and that Wall Street would really feel some pain about. So, for example, one such thing would be really meaningful control over the trade in derivatives. Another would be separating out the derivative trade from the banking industry. And another would be scaling back the largest institutions, so colloquially breaking up the banks. And what Wall Street had effectively done is rule all of those. Well, derivatives had been a little bit in the mix, but they had a ton of loopholes built into what had come out of the House and what was coming out of the Senate Banking Committee. The other things had just been ruled off the table altogether. They weren't part of the discussion. And, of course, that's always the sign of an industry's political power when they're not just winning the debate, but they're able to frame the debate to keep out of the conversation the things that they most fear. And that's what Wall Street had done very successfully until the last couple of weeks. In the last couple of weeks, as the process has moved forward in the Senate and in the wake of the scandal around Goldman Sachs and in sort of as we near the 2010 November elections, things have changed in a pretty interesting way. So the things that I said have been off the table are now on the table. Whether they pass or not, we don't know. But there's a real effort, not necessarily as far as one might like, but it's pretty substantial to break up the biggest banks, an amendment offered by Senators Brown and Kaufman from Ohio and Delaware, respectively. The New York Times writes today that they think that such an amendment, if it actually gets introduced and isn't blocked, has a very good chance of passing. There's very aggressive derivatives regulation that has been incorporated into the Senate bill from an unlikely source, which is Blanche Lincoln, the senator from Arkansas.
Yeah, what happened to her?
She is the chair of the Agricultural Committee. She is among the most Republican of the Democratic members of the Senate, had been very hostile to doing anything meaningful in this area. She is facing a very vigorous primary fight in Arkansas, and turns out this kind of pressure makes a difference, and suddenly she became very tough on the big banks, and so tough that the White House is trying to undo what she's done. So that's come into play, and there are other efforts to really separate out some of the most speculative activities from the commercial banks, including an important amendment that's going to be offered by Senators Merkley and Levin.
So we have the White House try to rein in Blanche Lincoln from the right.
That's correct.
Remarkable development.
That's correct. And there was a remarkable story also in the Washington Post 2 days ago relying on unnamed lobbyist sources saying things very close to, the process is now getting completely out of control. Politicians are being politicians. Translation, they're being responsive to the public instead of to their donors. We really need a backroom deal to fix these problems, and our backstop is the conference, meaning the conference committee between that'll follow after Senate passage to reconcile the bills passed by the House and the Senate, and we can count on the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, to be the adult, their words, and sort of tamp down on the overzealous regulation that they now fear is going to come out of the Senate.
How does Wall Street target these things? So they try to pick off certain senators to do their work for them. They like target Republicans, sort of center right Democrats. What is their preferred mechanism of action in setting the frame of the debate?
Well, it's a mix. Wall Street traditionally is a Democratic-leaning industry. They're still funding majority Democrats. In the 2008 election, they were heavily Democratic. Nonetheless, sort of the ideology rests on these kind of regulatory issues. They're more dependable friends are in the Republican Party. So what they want is to be able to count on a solid block of Republicans, meaning the entirety of the Senate caucus, to vote with them and to peel off some of the centrist, so-called centrist Democrats, or any not more liberal Democrats who align with them on particular issues, maybe because of their some specific thing in the home state. And that's what they've been sort of going for. They feel that the process is getting out of control right now. It remains to be seen how it's going to play out.
And you had a column that came out a day or two ago about the increasing concentration of the financial sector, which was actually rather stunning to read. So could you just recount how things have gotten concentrated in the last couple of years?
Well, it's been at least a 25-year process of concentration. But in the last decade, we've seen a real surge. So you've seen the top, say, three commercial banks with, I think, three times the level of concentration, three times the market share that they had a decade ago. And amazingly, the biggest Wall Street firms, at least the share of the market, are bigger than they were before the financial crisis, thanks to all the shotgun mergers that the federal regulators pushed through as the crisis was unfolding.
And why exactly is this bigness so bad?
There are a lot of reasons. The big companies benefit from the market perception, which is true, that they will be bailed out if they face failure. That does a bunch of things. It means that they get a implicit market subsidy. They're able to borrow capital or access capital at cheaper rates than smaller institutions, so they've got an unfair advantage over smaller institutions. They do, in fact, get access to taxpayer bailouts, as we've now seen. They undertake much more risky activities. So the top five commercial banks control 97% of the derivatives trade among banks, about 90% of the total financial derivatives trade. So this is all the speculative activity is really very highly concentrated among these super big banks. And they're the only ones who really have the capacity to engage in all this speculative activity that serves no social purpose, but it risks the health of the overall financial system. And at least as importantly, they gain enormous political power to make sure that there's no proper regulation. They have far more lobbyists. They have obviously the ability to spend much more on campaign finance. And they do the kind of things we're talking about with Pete Peterson. They can invest in the world of ideas that you just would not see smaller institutions doing. Also, incidentally, they serve consumers less well and are less responsive to community needs and on and on. The big banks serve no social benefit. There are no economies of scale for banking, say, at above $100 billion, and we've got big banks now that are at least 10 times that size.
Yeah, but they have Congress in their pocket.
There are some political economies of scale, but no market
yeah. And finally, where does the White House stand on this? Are they pretty much doing Wall Street's work as well, or is this most of the chicanery going on in Congress?
from the White House side, I think it's a mix. I think they want to sort of rein in some of the worst abuses, but they don't want to fundamentally challenge the structure of Wall Street. I don't think they believe in breaking up the biggest institutions, and I don't think they believe that Wall Street should be a smaller size of the overall economy. And they oppose measures that would push in those directions.
Why? Material interests, ideology, combination of the two?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. If you look at the individuals who are the key policymakers, people like Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, they are not from Wall Street, but they're certainly of Wall Street. They're of a Wall Street mentality. Summers did make a non-trivial amount of money in a sort of little consulting gig on Wall Street. But they hang out with these guys, they identify with them, and they believe in them. And the choice by Obama to put them in charge of economic policymaking sort of was going to inevitably lead to this perspective, and it has. So there is that. There's also probably a belief that, you know, I think there's sort of a bias more generally to the status quo and to the establishment, and that there's a belief in regulation, which is to say they think, you know, empowered regulators can get these institutions under control and stem the worst abuses. And I think that is putting way too much faith in regulators and not giving sufficient respect for the regulatory evasive capacity of the big banks. So they'll always be able to evade regulations, especially because their size gives them these enormous balance sheets where they can hide stuff, either off balance sheet or offshore. The regulators can't keep up with institutions of this size. If we got smaller banks, then I think the regulators will be more empowered and better able to do their jobs.
All right, thank you. I've been speaking with Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen based in Washington, D.C. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the new single from the great MIA, a bit of Born Free. Bye.